Thank you for our musicians. Aren't we fortunate? And I also want to recognize especially our pianist. The pianists oftentimes are overlooked because they are on the sidelines, but they provide the foundation for our soloists to do so well. So thank you to all of you. We have talked this week about reversing disease, reversing dis-ease. And so I couldn't help but to perhaps have one of our last morning sessions focus on reversing broken relationships from bitter to better. The story is told by Ernest Hemingway. He writes a story about the Capitol, and he talks about a father and a son. A young son, a young teenager, and somehow they have a big argument, and the relationship fractures, and they go different ways. Now, the boy's name is Taco. The story plays in Madrid, the capital of Spain. There are many, many Pacos. Paco is a very common name in Spanish territories. And the father begins to have second thoughts. He thinks about the relationship that has been broken, fractured. He's becoming increasingly desperate. He doesn't know where his son has gone to. He doesn't want to lose his son. And in despair, he goes to the local newspaper and he writes a special announcement. He buys some space, and there's an announcement, and it says, Paco, all is forgiven. Your father, meet me tomorrow at the post office here in Madrid. The next morning, there are 135 Pacos. And they're all looking for forgiveness. They're all looking for a loving father. And so it's a very important issue to think about our lives and the important role that forgiveness must play to live life at its very, very best. We all need forgiveness. And so as we talk about this a little bit this morning, I'd like you to think about this. Is there someone that perhaps you need to forgive? Is there someone that perhaps you should forgive? And if you feel you have done nothing wrong, maybe then it should be easier for you to take the first step and to reach out to forgive. Think about someone that perhaps you need to send an email tonight. Maybe you should pen a letter and perhaps try to remedy and put together again a fractured relationship. And you say, well, the person that I'm resentful about, a person who has done something so desperate, so terribly to me, that man has died a long time ago. What are you going to do now? I want you to write that letter to that person who is gone a long time ago. He's no longer with you. Write the letter and then burn it. There is remedial value in going through these steps, the steps of forgiveness. And you know, when it comes to emotions, when it comes to forgiveness, there are always emotions involved. I'm not in guilt. Why should I send the letter? Emotions. Emotions are oftentimes the drivers that cause us to act in ways that might actually harm us. Now, this week, we have pretty much talked about, much of it, about atherosclerosis, a narrowing, a hardening of the arteries, an arterial rest that is building up on the inside of the arteries and that gradually obstructs the full flow of blood. So we've talked about hardening of the arteries. What about hardening of the attitudes? What about our emotions? Do they have an effect on our health? So let me tell you a little story. This physician at Harvard University, many years ago, had an unusual young patient by the name of Tom. Tom had suffered from a gun wound close to his midsection, and the stomach was actually visible through a hole that didn't want to heal. The surgeon had made the operation, but somehow the wound didn't want to heal, and it afforded this physician now an unusual opportunity to look into the inside of a person's stomach. This was a researcher. He was very intrigued by what he saw. He noticed, as he observed this patient's coming again and again and again to examine the non-healing wound, he noticed that when the patient came to him calm and relaxed, the color of the inside of the stomach lining, was kind of pinkish. But then he noticed that when the patient came in agitated, upset obviously, emotionally engaged in a very negative way, and he looked into the stomach, then he noticed that the stomach lining, the inside of the stomach, was deep red, crimson red. And he began to wonder, could the emotions of a person have something to do with the color of the inside of a stomach? As a matter of fact, it was so intrigued that he was actually hoping that this patient's wound would not heal so that he would have access for many, many more times to visit this person. The story is reported in the annals of Harvard University. And so I wanted, could we have our first slides here? Russell, are you here? Is there something you can do for me? Russell to the aid. I had it all set up. It worked very, very well. But maybe this is a good time to acknowledge our technical people in that booth back there that make it possible for us, isn't it? Yeah, thank you. I don't need this, no. The first picture was showing. Why not the second one? So you take it, you can take a deep breath. You can say a special prayer. And we can thank the Lord for the goodness that He has shown to us in turning our lives around and providing the forgiveness that we don't really deserve, but that we can claim freely from Him, isn't it? He turned our lives around. He made us free from the burdens that we have carried. Oh. Now everybody is running back there to checking things out. It was there. We're making progress. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Whoever is in charge of having done this wonderful thing here. So we started talking this morning. We talked about the unusual experience that this physician had by being able to observe a relationship between emotions and the color of the inside of the stomach. And the color is affected by the production of gastric juices, acids. And these acids are being poured out in response to emotions. If you have irritable, strong, hateful, resentful emotions, there is more acid being produced in that stomach, and that then turns the lining of the stomach into a deeper crimson red. So we begin to understand now more and more that harbored negative emotions can turn the inside of the stomach lining into an engorged area and to secrete large amounts of this gastric acid. Emotions then can break down the life force and invite disease and death. It all depends on the kind of emotions that you have. These negative emotions can actually promote asthma and migraines and ulcers. They can lead to a burst of an angina attack or even a heart attack. And we even believe that negative emotions carried on over time may contribute to the development of cancers. And it's not so important what emotions you have experienced, but emotions that you carry forward. What emotions do you harbor? When stress comes to in our lives, it's not so much what the kind of stress is, but how you relate to it. This high society woman would check into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York regularly. She would always come every so often, and she knew, she had made it clear so that everybody knew on the staff that when that lady comes, she's always in the penthouse suite, the best that we have. And there is no one nearby because she wants to have it absolutely quiet. Don't disturb her, no phone calls, absolutely nothing. This is her time to think, this is her time to contemplate, to look at her life, and this is her private time, this is her special time of meditation. No one disturbs her, no sound, everything quiet. She had checked in. And she wasn't there for 15 minutes when all of a sudden she heard the banging on a piano. And she was upset. She was very upset. She called down at the front desk, and it was already after hours. And they knew nothing else to do but call the general manager who was at home. They called the general manager at home and said, Mrs. So-and-so is here, and she's really upset because we made a mistake. She's ready to check out. The general manager got into his car, drove as fast as he could to the hotel, lifted himself up to the highest floor with the elevator, and there he saw this very enraged woman. And he said, I'm so sorry. We made a terrible mistake. I don't know what else I can do, but everything is taken care of. Every bill is canceled. We can let you stay an extra week here. We are just totally apologetic that we have placed Arthur Rubinstein next to your room and the grand piano that he brought. And she said, Arthur Rubinstein, Arthur Rubinstein. And all of a sudden, she said, Arthur Rubinstein, can I see him? Can I sit at his feet? And she was now a totally changed person. What had really changed? It was the same person. It was the same room. It was the same noise, the same sound. What had changed? Noise had turned into music because she had a different attitude, and she couldn't get enough of the great pianist. Attitudes. Attitudes. Attitude. Emotions. Emotions can cause and promote dis-ease, or it can promote health. Now, you see, our health and our happiness often depends in part on how we react to life's challenges and how we resolve daily problems. You see, it's this whole process of solving problems that really gives meaning to our lives. When I have a problem to face, I welcome it. I said, here's an opportunity to see how God is revealing himself, to see what kind of resources do I have to manage this kind of a problem. What can I do to help someone? Problem solving can actually give meaning to life. Through the often painful struggle of solving problems, we grow mentally, we grow emotionally and spiritually, and we develop deeper insights. So, I like to suggest that those things that hurt may actually instruct and teach us. Wise people, therefore, welcome problems. They accept problems cheerfully. They even accept the pain that some of these problems sometimes bring because they know they will grow from the experience. On the other hand, we can also try to avoid problem solving. How do we do this? We rationalize. We blame things on others. We ignore problems. We deny problems. We drown problems. We don't face problems. Instead of dealing with problems, getting through these problems, we try to get out of these problems all too often. And you see, when that happens, you are avoiding growth. You stay with your bad habits. You live a bored life. You can live a life of stagnation. On the other hand, if you welcome problem solving when they happen, not that you search, not that you seek them out, not that you want to solve other people's problems, when people come to you, you have a great opportunity to personally grow, to develop insights, to develop understanding, and to have a life that is becoming enriched because of the struggles that you have had. The story is told of a very soft-hearted man. He was a scientist, he was a researcher, he was very observant, and one time he found a cocoon, and he noticed that the cocoon was breaking open just a little bit. There was a small slit there in the cocoon, and he noticed that the little evolving monarch butterfly was trying to break out of the cocoon and become this gorgeous butterfly. And he saw this pupa struggling there to breaking out of the cocoon. And then because he was such a soft-hearted man, he got his special scissors and he opened up the cocoon so that the pupa, the butterfly, could easily escape the imprisonment. What he didn't know is that for the rest of his life, that butterfly never was able to fly because the small slit that was there forced the evolving butterfly to squeeze all the fluids out of the evolving wings. And now he was no longer a butterfly because the wings were no longer able to carry out their function because they were swollen because of fluid that was still there. So this is an important lesson again of welcoming challenges, welcoming problems and dealing with problems and not just trying to get out of them. So I want to make the point here this morning that it's not so important as how we perceive and relate, the most important thing that we need to keep in mind is how do we relate to the stresses of life? How do we relate to our problems that are coming to our way? Are we trying to get out of them or are we going to try to solve them? Experience then will actually make us bitter or better. Life and experiences will either make us bitter or better. It all depends on how we relate to these issues. You see here, the difference between bitter and better is only one letter. What's the letter? I. When you think that your life has to turn around you, You are the center of the universe, and you are the all-important person. Be careful, because then you're always concerned about your rights. And that opens you then up for disappointments, obviously, because nobody's doing everything right just for you the way you want it. You want to have your rights taken care of. Be careful, because it opens widely the doors for resentment and for bitterness and for anger. It opens up the doors to hatred and to fear and to guilt. And these are the negative emotions that then deplete us of our emotional energies. And these are the very blockages that stunt the life-giving streams of human interaction and cause our spirit to shrivel, just like the wings of the beautiful monarch butterfly. You may call this spiritual atherosclerosis, a hardening of the attitudes, a narrowing of our emotions. This is an incredible competition. This is like a monsoon in the Philippines. Can you hear me all right? So we're talking here about life will make us either bitter or better. The only difference is one letter, the letter I. When our life turns around ourselves only, then we are bound to be disappointed. We have to experience and deal with resentments and bitterness and anger and hatred and fear and guilt and actually enslavement. Let me give you an example of how these emotions can destroy us. A lady came to my office some years back, and she ostensibly came because she said she was depressed and she couldn't shake her binge eating. So she had gained quite a bit of weight. And as I was taking an inventory to ask her, you know, what does she eat? When does she eat? What are some of the emotions involved? It wasn't very long when she blurted out, "She did this to me. She did this to me. My husband, they did it to me." And I said, "Tell me what happened." I mean, I could hardly calm her down. She said, my husband and her, they went on a trip and there it happened. And I said, "Really?" Now, I do not condone affairs. But you know, these things do happen in life. They do happen. How do you deal with them? And I said, "Tell me, when did this affair actually take place?" 13 years ago. For 13 years, she was filled with resentment, with bitterness, with anger, with hatred, with guilt, because of what this woman and her husband had done. She had become totally obsessed with this other woman. She had her tracked. She even knew her weight. She knew her dresses. She resented her for what she had done to her husband. There was bitterness. There was hate. It was all there, the instinctive means of revenge. And it created an emotional focus towards that other person. It was that other person that had wronged her, that dominated her thoughts, her emotions, her decisions, and making room for severe depression. And that, of course, oftentimes then can lead to eating, excessive eating, pacifying foods. 13 years. The emotional focus on that other woman. Here's my question. Did that help to restore her marital relationship? Should she have not used the time to perhaps develop her own self and become the best person that she could be to handle these kind of issues in life? No. It was the poor me story. They did this to me, feeling sorry for herself instead of processing the pain. 13 years. So she would come again and again, and we began to process some of these issues in her life, especially in her emotional makeup. And then she finally gained some insight, and then she summarized it very well. I wrote it down, and I copied it for you today, what she said after several sessions. She said, "The moment I started to hate that woman, I became her slave. The moment I started to hate that woman, I couldn't enjoy my work anymore because she controlled my thoughts. I became fatigued. The work I once enjoyed became drudgery. Even vacations ceased to be a joy. I couldn't escape her tyrannical grasp on my mind, and I focused on my life and what I was going to do with it. It only changed when I began, finally, to focus on my life and to focus on what I was going to do with that occurrence that had happened 13 years ago." What a tragic waste. You know what she needed to do? Well, she needed to turn her anger and her bitterness into forgiveness. She needed to begin to be forgiving to this other person. And in the process, then, she would gain insight and self-understanding, developing herself, coping with the issues of life, developing a greater sensitivity, developing personal growth, perhaps visiting a marriage counselor with her husband together, and to begin to move forward in moving towards freedom again. And that can only happen through the major step of forgiveness and acceptance. No, we do not condone what happened there, but we're also realistic to recognize when something like that happened, we need to take inventory of ourselves. Can this be taken care of? Is it salvageable? Can I forgo my attitudes of bitterness and resentment? Can I begin to find the energy, perhaps through God, to begin the element of trusting again? Oh yes, it will take time. Both partners have to make commitments. They have to stand by these commitments so that trust hopefully can be rebuilt and a marriage can be saved and perhaps become a stronger marriage than without these circumstances. So the magic here then is forgiveness. It's a difficult part. People always say, well, forgive and forget. Oh, forgiving, that's hard enough. God can help us to forgive. We become more mature as we do. We can learn to forgive. But to forget, to forgive, that can happen in a moment's time. Justification. To forget, that involves sanctification, where you don't rehash these things. Anytime something happens, you begin to rehash it in your mind. No, Lord, let me not say anything to him. Oh, I want to tell him he has done this to me. No. Let it go. Lord, give me strength. Let it go. Let me not stir the pot again and again and again. And gradually, it becomes less and less and less prominent in your mind and in your heart. And forgetting, forgetfulness begins to set in due time. And then you can go from justification to sanctification to glorification. That's the process. It takes everything we have. And it takes more than what we have. It takes divine help. But once we have recognized that we have been receiving forgiveness, should it not be possible to forgive others too? I want to share with you a final story. A story about Mrs. Hannah. Oh, she resented that verdict. Lifetime in prison. She hated the judge who said lifetime in prison. They should have given me the death sentence. He is the man that took the only thing I had in my life, my only daughter. He abused her and he killed her. The only thing that I had, I'd already lost my husband and now my daughter, gone. And every day she would be in the basement and she had this big board there and she had the darts and she threw those darts at the picture of this murderer, the man who had taken the most precious possession she had in her life. She hated him more than anything else. And she was totally unaware that she was becoming imprisoned in her own prison of hate. And then a Gideon came to her house. You know the Gideons, those Bible distributing people that place these Bibles into hotel rooms? A Gideon came to her house. He knew Mrs. Hannah. He knew what she had gone through. And very sensitively he said, Mrs. Hannah, I'm going to visit the man that's taken the most precious possession he ever had. I will visit him in prison. And I wonder if you would be prepared to take this Bible and sign your name in it so I can give it to him. No! Absolutely no! How could you even ask this? I mean, she was furious and she sent him out the house. And just as he left the door, he said, Mrs. Hannah, how can God forgive us if we cannot forgive others? Oh, she was angry. The audacity for this man to ask her to do the impossible. But then the thoughts went through her mind in the days and weeks that came. He said, how can God forgive us if we cannot forgive others? The thought was there all the time. Even as she threw the darts at the picture of this man that had killed her daughter. But it became less and less and less. And as she thought about God's forgiveness to us, as she began to pray about this, she reaches out for the phone and she calls the Gideon man and she said, sir, I'm not absolutely sure. Would you please come maybe now I'm ready to sign that book, that Bible. The Gideon came, Miss Hannah was there, he brought the Bible, and then Mrs. Hannah took that Bible and she said, can we pray first? She said, Lord, give me strength to do that which I cannot do in my own power. Her conviction, you see, had grown. That the minister at the graveside was right when he said, it was meant for evil, but good may come from it. And gradually as she prayed more and more, her feelings of hatred disappeared. She gradually found release from those very negative emotions. And when the Gideon came and gave her the Bible, she opened it up and she wrote, "Mrs. Hannah loves you." As she looked at what she had written, she could hardly believe it herself. But when the Bible was delivered, a miracle took place. You see, that murderer had been growing up as an orphan. No one had ever told him that he was loved. None. This Bible and this inscription, "Mrs. Hannah loves you," made such a powerful impression on him that he ultimately became a born-again Christian. As a matter of fact, he took the chaplaincy course while in prison, and he became the chaplain to the prisoners in that enclosure. He became a new man that now saw his greatest joy in ministering to others. Now he was able to share that love that was expressed for the first time by Mrs. Hannah with others, people around him. But something else happened. The love note not only changed the murderer, the love note also changed Mrs. Hannah. The old, embittered Mrs. Hannah died, and a new Mrs. Hannah lived. Why? Because she discovered peace and freedom through forgiveness and acceptance. Are there people in your life that perhaps are looking for forgiveness? Could it be that the prisoner is not the person that wronged you, but it's you who's still carrying the negative emotions? It's a very powerful question with much consequence. Let me finish up with a very touching story, another touching story, this time from a New York City cab driver working in Manhattan. He wrote, "I arrived at the address and honked the horn. And after waiting for a few minutes, I walked to the door and knocked. 'Just a minute,' answered an elderly, frail voice. I could hear something being dragged across the floor. After a long pause, the door opened and a small woman in her 90s stood before me. She wore a pink dress with some flower design on it and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it like something out of the 1940 movie. By her side was a small nylon suitcase. The apartment looked as no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There was no clock on the wall. There was no knickknacks of utensils on the counter. In the corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. 'Would you carry my bag out to the car?' she asked. I took the suitcase to the cab and then turned to assist the woman. She took my arm, and we then walked slowly towards the curb. She repeatedly thanked me for my kindness. 'It's nothing,' I told her. 'I treat my customers that way always. I would do it because I think it could be my mother, and I would treat her that way too.' 'Oh, you are such a good boy,' she said. When we got into the cab, she gave me an address and she asked me, 'Oh, could you drive me through downtown Manhattan?' 'Manhattan? It's not the shortest way,' I answered her quickly. 'Oh, it don't matter. I'm not in a hurry. I have no hurry whatsoever. I'm on the way to a hospice.'" You all know what a hospice is. The final stop of our life's journey. I looked into the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. I picked up a faint sparkle. "I don't have any family left," she continued in a soft voice. The doctor said, I don't have very long. I quietly reached over and turned off the meter in my cab. What route would you like me to take? I asked her. For the next 2 hours, we drove through the city, through Manhattan. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived as newlyweds. She had me pull up in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she danced with her husband the first time. Sometimes she asked me to slow down in front of a particular building or at a corner, and we would just sit there staring at the darkness, saying nothing. At the first glow of the morning sun was beginning to color the sky, she suddenly said, I'm tired now. Let's go now. We drove in silence to the address she had given me. It was a low building, like a small convalescent home, with a driveway that passed under a portico. Two orderlies came out of the building to the cab as soon as we pulled up. They were very solicitous and intently watching her every move. They must have been expecting her. I opened the trunk of my cab. I took her small suitcase to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair.
How much do I owe you?
She asked me while reaching into her purse. Nothing, I said.
Oh, you have to make a living,
she answered. There'll be other passengers. They will take care of things, I responded. Almost without thinking, I bent over and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly.
You gave an old woman a little moment of joy. Thank you, she said.
I squeezed her hand. And then I turned and walked into the dim morning light. Behind me, a door that was shut. It was the sound of the closing of a life. I didn't pick up any more passengers that shift. I drove aimlessly, lost in thought. For the rest of that day, I could hardly talk. What if that woman had gotten an angry driver or one who wouldn't be so patient? What if I had refused to take the run that day or if I had only honked once and driven off? Actually, I don't think I've done anything more important in my life than what I did that day. All of us, we are conditioned to think that our lives revolve around us. All of us are conditioned to think that our lives revolve also around great moments to remember. But great moments often catch us unaware, beautifully wrapped of what others may consider just a small event. And here is the lesson. Remember the lesson of this encounter. People may not exactly remember what you did. They may not exactly remember what you said, the words you used, but they will always remember of how you made them feel. And that is what will linger in their minds. Let me repeat this. People may not remember exactly what you did. They may not remember exactly what you said. They may not remember the exact word that you used, but they will always remember of how you made them feel. Let us pray. Father in heaven, you have made us feel good because of what Jesus did for you and that what you had planned to allow to happen. You gave the very, very best, and they murdered your son. But you maintained your love for those who murdered him, and you invite us to be a loving person, regardless of who the person is. We thank you for that love that you extended to us so that we give it to others. In Jesus' name, amen.